Good morning. Well, it's good that you're all here. And with all the hoopla that was going on this week about the end of the world and all, and I woke up this morning and I was still in my room. I was thinking, okay, this could be good news or bad news. Either the train left the station and I'm not on it. Yeah. It was good news. It was good news. You know, I know it's easy to poke fun and it's easy to laugh about it, but the Lord is coming back sometime, and there is an end to all things at some point. And I did get emails and a couple of calls and people asking about what did I think about all this stuff, because it made such a big splash in the news this last week or two. And, you know, the thing that was probably showing up the most on the news whenever a pastor would be interviewed about it was that Jesus says that nobody knows the hour or the day, not even himself. Only the Father knows, which is true enough. But I think there's really a deeper point in this whole thing that needs to be brought out. And that's that everything that Jesus did, everything that he taught us, everything that he lived, pointed to this moment. The moment that we occupy right now. And anything that we do to focus ourselves forward, focus ourselves on the future, is taking away from our presence in this moment. And especially to become preoccupied with end times and to focus everything out there and order everything that we do here, you know, based on some future date that we don't even know if it's correct or not, is a misuse of the time and the presence that Jesus has for us and his Father has for us. And so I think the most important thing is that we focus here now. We focus on the faces that are around us now. We become more heightenedly aware so that we can understand that God's presence is here right now. And then everything else will just take place as it does. The whole parable about the young virgins and the lamps and all of those stories were that we're supposed to be watchful, ready, aware, present to each other. Because at the end of all things, that will be a life without regrets. And that's what we want to do. If we fail to act now, if we fail to love now, if we fail to simply be present now because we're focused someplace else, you know, that's a recipe for regret. There are things that we could have done and had and shared. And Jesus is all about life and life abundantly. And that's the whole point to this. And so if the focus is here now, then praise God. I think that needs to be balanced. But yes, there is an end to all things. And even these pastors who keep trying to name the date and the time, well, guess what? A broken clock is right twice a day. So at some point, I guess somebody's going to be right. And praise God, that'll be just fine as long as we are living without regrets and living with God's presence right here and right now. So having said all that, I'm glad that we're still here. I'm glad that we can have this morning together. And, you know, to start out, it's interesting how things seem to converge. Coincidence? We don't think so. We've been talking for the last few weeks about several themes. And then I got an email from a friend of mine who actually copied a comment to a blog that another mutual friend of ours made. And it just really hit me right between the eyes. And I want to read part of it to you. And it's kind of a launching up point for what we can talk about this morning. And she was reacting to the notes of a sermon of a pastor on this blog. And her first line is, "I give up!" Exclamation point. "Christian spirituality eludes me. I must not be smart enough, spiritual enough, or my heart must be too hardened to understand what it is I'm supposed to do to know Jesus. What I wonder is how anyone knows Jesus at all. Knowing Jesus is confusing. Everyone who encounters him as he was alive, the crowds, the disciples, the Pharisees, John the Baptist, and King Herod, all ask who he is. I understand how everyone mentioned in that list did not know Jesus. Everyone except the disciples. Even the disciples didn't know Jesus? And Jesus lived side by side with them for 3 years? If Judas really knew Jesus, how could he have exchanged his relationship with Christ for a pocket full of silver? And if Peter knew Jesus, how could he have disowned the Lord 3 times to save his own life? If some of the disciples didn't know the Son of God in the flesh, how could any of us ever be expected to? Which brings me to another question. Can anyone ever know himself or herself, who they are, who they truly are, and what they are capable of in any moment? When it comes right down to it, isn't the filter of me, in quotations, and when I say me, I mean each individual, all that any of us have when it comes to knowing God? Born and raised in a predominantly Christian culture, when I say I give up, what I'm saying is I give up on organized religion. I give up on the idea that anyone knows God better than I know God myself. I like that line. Saying that is scary, though, because it flies in the face of my authoritative upbringing. Saying this means I no longer trust others' experience of God more than I trust my own. Saying this means I am on this faith journey utterly alone, yet connected to my Creator. Isn't that the truth for all mankind? We are alone, connected to God, and in the void of aloneness, we are joined together as one. Did Jesus need to pray? Another good question. Maybe in his humanity, Jesus experienced moments of forgetfulness. He was often alone in the middle of a crowd, yet always connected to the Father. Could it be Jesus entered into prayer with the Father to be reminded of who he was, which is something not easily explained? Could it be that we enter into the prayer of Jesus to be reminded who we are? Could the human condition be a perpetual state of spiritual amnesia? Someday I may experience the full weight of grace, and in that moment my man-made notions of God may leave altogether. Until then, I hope that it is true that Jesus died and now lives in me. Not only lives in me, but gives me life. Not only life, but the great consciousness of life. She makes four really good points. And the first one is basically, I wonder how anyone knows Jesus at all. Knowing Jesus is confusing. And, you know, as we look at all of our theology and all of our church teaching and we read the New Testament and we see all the confusion, she's absolutely right. Looked at that level, cognitively trying to understand who Jesus is, what he represents, how this whole thing fits theologically together. Is it Trinitarian? Is it this? Is it that? And how does all this work? It's confusing. And then if you add the weight of our salvation depends upon knowing the right Jesus, well, then it gets really scary, really frightening, too. Do I know the right Jesus? Have I got this all figured out? And the pressure that we feel. And then the next point, when it comes right down to it, is it the filter of me, my filter, my worldview, my experience and understanding of things, my particular mix of neuroses and compulsions and all of that stuff? Isn't that all I have when it comes to knowing God? Isn't it all just that learned imagery? I remember as a kid with the nuns teaching me, you know, God was always the white-haired, you know, elderly man up on the throne somewhere way up high, inapproachable, you know. And that imagery stays with you. It persists through childhood and into adulthood, and we still feel that. What was that first image that you had of God? How has that colored and persisted in your life? Can we ever be expected to move beyond our own expectations, our own imagery of who God we think is? And the relationship, how we think it's supposed to play out, how we were taught that it's supposed to play out. These are all really important bedrock questions. And then she says, I give up on the idea that anyone knows better than I know God myself. I mean, can we trust anything that anybody else says about God? Can we really? When a pastor tells us with absolute certainty and authority that the world's going to end at 6 p.m. PST on Saturday, May 21st, you know, thousands of people trusted him. Thousands of people emptied bank accounts. Pastor Mike was just telling us that there was a study that credit card expenditures went up tremendously over the last 3 or 4 days. You know? People trusted him. They believed him. Can we trust anything that anybody says? Can you trust me? Thank you. Only to a point. The point is that she's making is that we can't abdicate. Missed that one. We can't abdicate our journey to anybody else. I don't care if it's the Pope or it's me or the guy down the street. As soon as we are living their journey, we're not living our own. And that's the key here. These are the questions that she's asking. And then finally, could it be that we enter into the prayer of Jesus to be reminded of who we are? Could the human condition be a perpetual state of spiritual amnesia? It's so funny how these things come together. We just were talking about that a couple of weeks ago. That prayer really is being reminded of who we are, that we already have everything that we need in order to go where we need to go, which is back to the Father. He's already given us that. He told us, everything I have is yours. And he said, this kingdom that you search for out there someplace is really within. It's in your midst. It's in the midst of. Everything we have is here. We need to be reminded of that. There's nothing we've got to go get out there. We need to be reminded that God is here and now in this moment. So yes, we need to be reminded. Did Jesus need to be reminded? I think so. He was a man like us. How could he hang on the cross and say, my God, why have you forsaken me? If he didn't feel at that moment in his humanness that he had lost something important and needed to be reminded of who he was. All these questions, are they resonating with you? Have you ever asked them yourself? Have you ever felt this kind of helpless frustration, this disorientation? A sense that you just want to give up, just tune it all out, turn it off, turn it down, let it go so you can just be. I'd like to tell you that if you haven't, then I'm not sure you're taking your spiritual journey seriously enough. If you haven't doubted your faith, if you haven't gone through that dark night of the soul, then I think that you're probably living someone else's journey. If the path you're on feels familiar, if the path you're on feels safe, if the path you're on has a sense of you can see it going way down into the vanishing point, then you're probably on somebody else's journey, not yours. Because I'll tell you what, as soon as we move into our journey, all we can see is one step ahead. That lamp unto the feet idea that only throws a pool of light enough for a step at a time, that's the experience. And even more, it's like the path doesn't even materialize until you set your foot down. It materializes under your feet. There is a sense of disorientation. There's a sense of unknowing. There's a sense of not knowing where you're going, often in the spiritual life. And we think there's something wrong with us when we hit that. I'm telling you, that's when you know there's something right about what you're doing. Can you persist in the midst of that disorientation and confusion and frustration? Can you continue on in the path that you've chosen, trusting your God to always materialize the path under your feet? That's faith as defined by the Hebrew word. That's what faith is. Continuing to move without knowing, continuing to move without guarantee, without dates and times, without temple and ritual and practice and all those things that we think we need. Jesus is saying, you already have what you need. Don't need to worry about that. And don't worry about tomorrow either. It's all here. It's all now. It's all today. So in the midst of that, whether you buy that or not, another question arises. And that question is, if we're in this midst of unknowing and we're trying to discern God's voice in our head, how do we know it's God's voice we're hearing and not just our own head talking to ourselves? We hear that all the time. How do I know it's God's will? How do I know if this path that I'm taking is really what God wants me to do? How do I distinguish between God's will and my own desires? My own compulsions, my own needs, my own dysfunction. How can I make those distinctions? And so this is something that Jesus is trying to teach us. He's trying to get us to understand. We've been talking a lot here about identity versus behavior. And, I know those are just words to you. And I don't know if they mean anything at all. They've hit me so deeply that I keep wanting to share them with you. And I know that there's a limitation of how much you can get across with just words. But this foundational idea that Jesus is trying to move us away from mere behavior as the measure of anything and move us into pure identity, pure unity with himself, is so foundational. And I can sit here and say something shocking to you, like I don't even believe anymore that God really cares about our behavior, not in and of itself. And that shocks a lot of people. But behavior in and of itself doesn't mean anything if it's not matched by the interior transformation that allows that behavior to flow. Are we just conforming? Are we just following rules? These things are so critical for us to understand. And yet, in the communication that we have, either in a situation like this or just one-on-one, it is amazing how much is not communicated, you know, regardless of how many words are used. It's like we don't get through and things just kind of sail over. And I wish there was a way to bring certain things home, but, you know, the truth of the matter is when it comes to matters of the spirit, it's not cognitive, it's not intellectual. You can't transfer these things between mind to mind, heart to heart, soul to soul. They're truly and purely experiential. I can say that there's a huge difference between behavior and identity, and your head can go up and down, but until you experience something that brings it home to you in a way that starts to transform your life, it won't have any use to you. But I hope that by planting seeds, as Jesus was planting seeds in his hearers, that maybe it starts to move you in new directions. You know, each one of us has this narrow availability window, I guess I'll call it. This narrow space within which communication can flow. And the first thing is that the communication has to disturb you enough, has to shake you enough, stir you enough that you realize you're hearing something different than you already think you know. Because that's the main thing that happens. That's what she's talking about in terms of this filter. We filter everything out. And if it's not jarring enough, then we just assume that it's what we already understand. If it's too jarring, we get up and we leave the room or we throw a rock on the way out. And Jesus had to do this. Jesus never held back. He was as radical as he needed to be to get people to that place where they could understand, okay, wait a minute, I'm hearing something different now. I'm hearing something I haven't heard before. I'm hearing something that I need to consider. I'm hearing something that may be important. But in a room full of people, everybody's got a different window. And so you put one message out, and it's like the sower and the seeds. You know, some of it just blows on by. Some people are picking up those rocks and starting to get ready to throw, and other people are right in the middle. You know, you can't hit everybody all the time where they need to be hit, but you keep trying. Jesus kept trying, and people left him. At one point, a whole big group got up and left, and he turns to his closest friends, and he says, "Do you want to go also?" Could you imagine what that felt like to him? To have this message that was so deep and so real and so personal and so life-giving, and to have people just turn and walk away, and then have to turn to your friends and say, "You want to go too?" And good old Peter, "To whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, Lord." You got to love Peter. He just speaks first, asks questions later. But it's so true. And so in here we do the same thing. You know, we talk. We try to get the words to that friction point in your life to see if it can have any kind of effect. You know, but if you just let it be words, if it just exists here in these 30 minutes, 40 minutes, whatever that we have a chance to talk, it will never move into your life the way Jesus intended. It'll never become a way of life for you. Jesus is trying to get us to learn to discern between outward appearances and what's happening inside constantly. And if we don't get as ruthless about that process ourselves, then everything just stays at the surface level. We'll never understand how deep the rabbit hole goes until we actually go down the rabbit hole and find out for ourselves. You know, sometimes it's the absence of words that tell us more about a culture than the presence of words. And we were just talking about this last Wednesday in our study, where in Aboriginal tribes, especially in the South Pacific and in the in Indonesia area, linguists and anthropologists have discovered that these tribes don't have certain key words in their language at all that we consider key. Words like when. They don't have a word for when. They don't have a word for past and future. Don't have a word for hello and goodbye. Don't have a word for thank you. Don't have a word for want. When a culture doesn't even have words to express those concepts, you got to start to realize that you are in the presence of something radically different than what you are used to. It's not familiar. You're not in Kansas anymore. If you don't have a word for when, then you don't have a concept of past and future. If you don't have a word for hello and goodbye, then everything is an eternal present moment, an eternal now. There's no sadness when somebody departs. There's no joy when they return. They're either part of your moment or they're not. If there's no when, there are no birthdays. There's no marking of time. There's no celebration of the passage of time. And all of this to us sounds less than human. How could I not be sad when my loved one goes away? How can I not be joyful when they return? How can I not want to mark my child's birthdays? And I'm not saying their culture is better, it's just different. If there's no word for want or thank you, then there's no concept of personal possession. There's no greed, there's no envy, there's no lack, because everything is shared, everything is communal. A culture like that functions more like one organism with many moving parts rather than a lot of individuals each seeking their own gain. And it's hard for us to understand that. But the ancient Hebrews, the Hebrews of Jesus' day, were also a communal society. Not that radically communal. They understood that there was past and future. They marked celebrations, certainly. They marked the cyclical calendar of the year. But they still understood that the individual existed for the community, and not the community existing to preserve the rights of the individual. And they understood that that voice that speaks to you, they understood it and spoke of it as a community of voices within that was supposed to reflect the community of voices without. That the inward condition and the outward condition were supposed to match up somehow. They were supposed to be one. They were supposed to be united. When you think about it, the greatest insult, the greatest condemnation that Jesus reserved for anyone, and go home and read Matthew 23 if you want to get a full dose of what he said to those Pharisees and those religious authorities, was that you are a hypocrite. Why? Because a hypocrite is someone whose inside voices, the interior community, does not match the exterior community. If there's anything that looks forward in Jesus' theology, forward to the kingdom, it's when the kingdom within is reflected in the kingdom without. That our society and our institutions actually reflect kingdom values because enough people have had their heart lights turned on. We hit the tipping point where enough people are living in kingdom that it actually starts to move out into the institutions that keep us together as a group. The interior needs to match the exterior. We need to look beyond the surface appearances of things and look deeply into the interior, and see if there's life there. See if there's preservation there. See if there's kingdom there. See if the Father is there. And Jesus uses many different word pictures, analogies, and metaphors to try to get us to start to discern and detect the differences between inner and outer. And if you take a look at your bulletins this week, which are correct this week, we got them right. May 22nd, Matthew 7, 9 to 11. This comes right off Jesus saying, ask, seek, and knock. If you ask, you will be given. If you seek, you will find. And if you knock, it will be opened to you. And then he illustrates it with this little word picture. Or what man is there among you who, when his son asks for a loaf, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, he will not give him a snake, will he? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father, who is in heaven, give what is good to those who ask him? Now, this, like so many of Jesus' lines and sayings and teachings, exists on multiple levels. At the top level, it works perfectly well. We understand exactly what he's talking about. We have children of our own. We have parents of our own. We know the identification within the family and how strong it is and how much we love our children and will give them what is good for them and try to meet their needs when they express them to us. How much more will your Father in heaven do that for you? Why are you so worried about it? Why do you think if you ask your Father, he won't give you? Now remember, all of Jesus' teaching, this saying, Sermon on the Mount, is all given within the context of kingdom, which is that heightened awareness, that quality of life that occurs in the here and now when we are living according to these principles. So if you think if I ask for that job, will I get the job? You know, if I'm seeking a husband that, or wife, the perfect husband or wife, I'm going to find them. Or if I'm knocking on the window of that Cadillac and looking past the sticker at the leather seats, Jesus isn't talking about those things. He's talking about the deeper things that will not be denied because your Father loves you like a perfect parent. So even we imperfect parents have a glimpse of what it means to be a perfect parent. But on a deeper level, there's something else going on here. When Jesus talks about loaves and stones, first of all, the word for bread there, for a loaf, sometimes it's called bread, but it's not a good translation. It should be a loaf. And it's to be contrasted, lachma, as opposed to matzah. The matzah was the unleavened flatbread that was for use in the Passover. But the lachma, the artos in the Greek language, was a fully risen loaf. And in Palestine at the time, they were round and they were smooth and they were brown. And they looked a heck of a lot like the river rocks that were so prevalent and in use and on the side of the road, in the streets, and in the fields. And from a distance, you could have a stone and a loaf right next to each other, and they look pretty much the same. Remember when Jesus is in the wilderness, and the devil says, hey, turn these stones into loaves, right? Well, they already look like loaves. It wouldn't be too hard, right? And looked at from a distance, they look the same. But try to eat the wrong one, and you'll find out pretty quickly that what's inside is vastly different, even though what's on the outside looks the same. And if you ask for a fish, will you get a snake? Well, when you think about the sea snakes and the other creatures in the ocean from a distance or through the surface tension of the water, they can look similar. But sea snakes are among the most poisonous in the world. Get the wrong one, and not only do you not preserve life, you can actually lose it. Bread and fish in the Galilee, in that rural area, those were the staples of life. Jesus uses those to make his point. We look to the bread as a preservation of life, but if it's a stone, it can't do that. We look to the fish as a preservation of life, but if you get the wrong one, it will take it from you. Luke even adds scorpions and eggs, and you think, what? How in the world are those similar? But Pliny and other ancient writers tell of a white scorpion that was prevalent in Palestine at the time, that when it rolled up into a ball, looked about the shape, the size, and the color of an egg. And they did look similar. And he even tells about an ancient assassination technique where they'd hollow out an egg and put a small scorpion in there, and you break it open and the thing strikes and you're gone. Once again, the egg, the symbol of preservation of life, symbol of the generation of life, or something that can take it from you. See where Jesus is going with this? Look beyond the surface of things. Make sure that the inward and the outward are one, or there is going to be no life for you. Matthew 7:15-20, beware of the false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? So every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. The good tree cannot produce bad fruit, nor can a bad tree produce good fruit. And every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. So then you will know them by their fruits. Okay, sheep and wolves. That's pretty easy. The sheep was a symbol of innocence, pliability, sincerity, honesty. In their culture, sheep were huge. It was one of the clean animals that they could eat, and they had their flocks. And, sheep are not the brightest bulbs on the tree. They will just do whatever you tell them to do. They'll walk right up to the point that you cut their throats and hang them upside down. But that was a sheep, as opposed to the wolf, who was the ravenous, feral animals that hunted in packs, and typically hunted the sheep, of course, the domesticated sheep. But there's another level to this one as well. In that culture, the outermost garment that people would wear was their talit, their prayer shawl, which is usually made of 100% wool, or in some cases was actually a sheep's skin. And the Pharisees would exaggerate the size of their talit, their prayer shawls, and they would have the tassels hanging down and brushing along the ground because they wanted to show people how pious they were. So literally they were wrapped in sheepskin as they walked around parading themselves. Do you see where Jesus is going with this? Everybody understood this. This was not rocket science to that culture. He says they walk around like sheep among you, honest, sincere, innocuous, friendly, able to preserve your life, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves who will not lift a finger to help you to get into the kingdom, but neither will they. The difference between the two, the outward and the inward. He says, yeah, you look great on the outside like a whitewashed tomb, but what's inside? Yeah, you wash the outside of the cup, but what about the inside of the cup? All this inward and outward stuff that's not matching up is the worst thing in Jesus' vocabulary. At Mark 11:12-17, on the next day, when he had left Bethany, this is right at the beginning of the Passion Week, of Holy Week, he became hungry. Seeing at a distance a fig tree and leaf, he went to see if perhaps he could find anything on it. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he said to it, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples were listening, kind of uncharacteristic for Jesus. And what I don't have in this part of the story, when they come back the next day, the tree is all withered and dead, right? But then they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who were buying and selling in the temple, and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who were selling doves, and he would not permit anyone to carry merchandise through the temple. And he began to teach and say to them, is it not written, my house shall be a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a robber's den? And there he's alluding to Isaiah and Jeremiah in those two capitalized areas. The same thing is going on here, even though it's a little bit more veiled for our ears. You need to know a little bit about fig trees. Fig trees in first century Palestine were also symbols of abundance and symbols of richness. And the spring figs were considered the best of all the figs that ripened during the year. But they ripened between May and June, in late spring, early summer, right before summer came into place. And the interesting thing about a fig tree, unlike all other trees, the fruit comes first and the leaves come after. After winter, the fruit buds first and then the leaves. So Jesus is walking around, and this was right before Passover, so it would have been late March, early April. It wasn't the season yet for figs. That's still a couple of months off. But he sees a tree that is in full flower in terms of its leaves and its foliage. Well, knowing that the figs come first, one would assume there's got to be fruit there, and I'm hungry. And he goes up there to look for it. From a distance, it looks verdant. From a distance, it looks life-giving. But when he gets up to it, he finds that it's barren, and it can't help him. And then he goes to the temple. And what does he see at the temple? This magnificent structure with the smoke rising from the court. Thousands of years of Jewish tradition, culture, piety, purity, all embodied in that magnificent structure. And he walks inside, and what does he see? Inward and outward. From the outside, it looks like it can sustain life. Inwardly, there's nothing there. You have turned it into a den of thieves. This house of prayer that was supposed to be a light to the nations is just a marketplace. Nothing wrong with a marketplace. But when you're looking for figs and you find none, what do? You have to walk away. Jesus is telling us these things to try to get us to understand there needs to be continuity between the interior and the exterior if there's going to be any life, if there's going to be any kingdom. How can we know if someone else is unified, if someone else is integrated in this way? He says, by their fruit. Well, what fruit is that? How do we know what that fruit is? Is it just by the behavior? We have lots of good behavior going on with some people. Does that mean their interior and their exterior is unified? From the outside, It's almost impossible to tell. From a distance, it's impossible to tell. We can look at televangelists and render all sorts of judgments as they sit in, you know, golden chairs and have, you know, big hair and all that sort of thing. But we don't know. Big hair isn't a moniker of a bad spirit. We don't know. Between stones and loaves at a distance, you can't tell. But get up close. What is happening in the innermost circle of that person's lives, in their closest relationships? Are they leaving people better than they found them? Is there a sum total of unity in their lives that emanates from the closest relationships out to the most distance? That's the fruit. Is it unity or is it division? Is it closeness and communication or is it dysfunction? We can't really judge others. How about ourselves? Now it even gets trickier, doesn't it? I have all sorts of good intentions. I have all sorts of behavior that I consider good. Does that mean that I'm integrated inwardly and outwardly? Can I make those distinctions for myself? Do I know that that voice in my head is not just me talking to myself, trying to justify what I want to do anyway? How do we make those kind of distinctions? I think what I want to do is to submit to you the only way that's worked for me. And I probably have told this story in here before, but I'll tell it again because it's a perfect illustration. You know, 15, 20 years ago when I landed back in an evangelical church, I immediately ended up in a band within a couple of months. And so I was playing worship music for the first time and didn't know what worship music was. I'm just up there playing music like I have always done for the last 2 decades before that. But I noticed that every time I got up to play, I was nervous. Every time I got up to play, there was this tension, the butterflies, all that sort of thing. And if I ever got up to do a solo or something, then I was practically a wreck. And I'm thinking, after a while, what in the world's going on here? You know, there's 100 people out there soaking wet. It's a small church. They're not going to remember what I did from the week before to the week next. It's kind of nice. You get a clean slate every Sunday. Why am I so nervous? Why am I so worried about what I'm doing? And I realized it's because I was more concerned about what they thought of me than what I was going to give to them. I was being codependent with the rest of the church. I needed something from them. It was all about me. My motives were not pure. I wasn't trying to give them a gift or join into the gift of music with them. I was trying to get something, some sort of acceptance, some sort of validation, something that I needed. And it made me nervous. I think we all have a built-in way that we can look at the unity or disunity of our inward community and our exterior community. And that's by measuring your stress level. Measure your tension. Measure your anxiety. Because all those things are a measure of fear in your life. It's a measure of the conflict of interest that you have internally as you do the things that you do. If you're constantly anxious or tense or nervous, then you're worried about your standing. You're worried about your place at the table. You're worried about whether all this stuff is going to get you where you think you need to go. It's all about you. It's about meeting your needs. It's about getting where you think you're supposed to go. I can honestly tell you that at least in the area of music, when I get up here now, I have no nervousness. I sit down with this wonderful band and I just play. That's one area that I think I can say that I do that. Other areas, not so much. But music has become pure for me again. Or maybe for the first time. I can just play. It's not leading anywhere. It's not feeding anything. It's just being able to connect with these 4 other musicians. And for half an hour or 45 minutes, we just get to just soak in this wonderful sound. And share it with you. If your life feels more like that than the other, then you're doing a good thing. You know, it's 51%. Forget about 100% of the time. Just go for the 51%. That more often than not, you're not completely a basket case. Wouldn't that be nice? You know? More often than not, one more than half. Because when you get there, the tipping point starts to move you in all the areas. It permeates. That's what Jesus is saying. Seek first the kingdom and God's righteousness, and all else will be added. You don't have to go for every nook and cranny. Just go for the core. Are you nervous? Are you worried? Are you awake at night? Are you constantly scared and conniving and thinking and moving and trying to work out conversations before they is all that going on? Well, then your interior voices and your exterior voices are not in sync. They're not singing together. They're not in tune. And no matter what behavior you exhibit, it's not going to get you where you really want to go, where Jesus wants to take you, which is kingdom, which is the absence of all that stuff, all that fear, all those downward manifestations of it. The behavior doesn't get you there. The behavior, properly formed, is the result of the integration, the unity, the connection of your inside voices and your outside voices. This is what Jesus is trying to get us to understand. We can't know Jesus. We can't know the Father until we start to understand that they are one and they are about unity. This unity which obliterates the fear and allows us to just relax. We can't approach that until we first become unified, or at least agree that unity is our highest goal. If we can't even think that, then how in the world is any of the rest of this going to start to flow out? The man who sent me the original blog comment that I read to you all, he had a comment himself. And he said, he has only experienced God once. And it was just for a fraction of a second. And he was very specific. He said he was driving on the 101 just past the temple exit in Los Angeles. And for that fraction of a second, he had an experience of God that was intensely real to him. And then it was gone. And he said he would like more in his life. But he's afraid now that if he does want more too much, he's going to start manufacturing them and they won't be real. So that one will have to last him for the rest of his life. You know how old this man is? He's over 80. And he's living off of one experience. There's nothing wrong with that. If you got the one experience, that's great. Often people don't get any. I don't get many. But I'll tell you what's probably also in the mix here is that he's looking and waiting for a specific type of experience. Probably a religious experience, probably conforming to those images in his mind of what a religious experience, a spiritual experience, a revelation from God really is. And nothing is matching up. That one time he got one. But he's probably missing all these other moments because he's looking past them for the thing that he thinks and expects will be the one. We've got to learn what Jesus was telling us, that every moment can be a sacred moment. Every moment is a sacred moment. We either enter into it and realize that or we don't. But every moment is available to us. Can be that peak experience, can be that moment that we understand who God is a little bit more, and our stress level goes down a little bit more. I was talking to a couple of people over this last couple of weeks, and they told me, each told a story that connected with the other that was so beautiful. Both are children of alcoholic fathers. And they've had a really difficult time with their fathers. Lots of abuse, neglect, erratic behavior, and all that goes on with the child of an alcoholic parent. And this one girl, who's probably in her early 20s, was saying that one night she came back to her house and had dinner with her family. And kids. Had dinner with her family, and at the end of the dinner, her dad was sitting on the couch, and she was got up to leave, and she was saying goodbye, and she hugged her mom, and she hugged her sister, and she went to her dad, and she just held out her hand, and he took her hand, but he squeezed it. And there was just this moment of connection that she felt, and she realized she still loved her dad, regardless of all this stuff. And then she left and went home. And this other woman was talking about a moment with her father, and she's in her probably early 60s. And she said that she was at a family gathering, and her dad was doing what he always did, was had about one drink too many, and was sitting on the couch about ready to pass out. And she went to him and said, "Dad, can I just take you up and put you to bed?" And he brightened up, woke up, and said, "Okay, sweetie, let's go." And he got up, and he took her arm, and she took his arm. And as they're walking up the stairs, she actually started to break down in tears at that moment, because she realized she still loved her father. She hated him for all the things that he had done, but she loved him too. And in that moment, it wasn't spectacular. It wasn't religious. It was a moment of pure connection. Jesus is teaching us a non-religious way to the Father. It's not even a spectacular way to the Father. It's grounded in life. Every mundane, normal detail. When you take your alcoholic father's hands and you look into his eyes and you realize you still love him, and you realize there's still a connection with you that's beyond blood, and you realize that there's something in you that you didn't even know existed, and this moment takes you beyond your own limitations, takes you beyond your resentments and your fears and your jealousies and your worry and your tension, and it brings you to a love that you didn't even know existed inside you, because it's connecting you to your Father's love, and you're starting to understand what that is and how that works and how you don't need to fix anything to enter into the connectedness. These fathers are still alcoholics. They're still doing what they do. But there's a moment of genuine connection and love that happens if we'll let it, if we'll enter in, if we'll take the hand of the person who's hurt us and offer to take them up the stairs to bed. Things happen that we would never expect. This is Jesus' way. This is where he's taking us. Jesus is telling us that our God is a humble God. Why? Because he is a humble man, and he and the Father are one. Jesus is telling us that our God is a vulnerable God. Why? Because Jesus is a vulnerable man. Jesus is telling us that our God is a servant God. Why? Because Jesus washed his friend's feet. We serve that kind of God. The kind of God who will wash our feet, who will be vulnerable, who will reach out to us even when we're most unlovely and still in the midst of all of our destructive behavior. That's our God. Can you let that sink in for a minute and not let it just be words, to understand what that means to have that kind of God as the creator of our universe, who is also humble and vulnerable and wishes to serve us, to give us every good thing? And let that lower your stress enough to be able to risk what it's going to take to see how deep the rabbit hole goes. Not to keep looking for spectacular moments, but enter into every moment and see what that brings in terms of God's Spirit. And to know we serve that kind of God. Let's pray. Father, it is so difficult to let go of the old images, and I know you know that, but help us. You sent your Son to us to show us in every way that he could, even by dying, the kind of God that you are and who he is and who we can be in you. Help us to relax. Help us to just go there. Help us to not let this be anybody else's journey but our own. To go out and find the things that we are convinced of in you, because we've lived them and we know that they're true. We love you, Father, because you first loved us. Thank you for loving us that way. Thank you for giving us everything that we need in order to find our way back to you in connection and unity and love. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.